I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another of our Saturday streams. And my guest in the first hour is Kate Fanning, also known as Bubba Kate Paris. We need to get to the bottom of these names. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hello. Yes, thank you for having me.
So you were recommended to me by Millennial Woes, who thinks highly of you. And I said, okay, well, if Woes vouches for you, I want to talk. I also saw that you are on Radio 314, also recommends you highly in my book. So can you tell my audience and me a little bit about yourself and your work? As far as I know, you are English and you are working in Great Britain for the rights of Indigenous Britons. And I just love to hear news like that. So I would like to hear in particular about your activism.
So I've been in politics for quite some time. I first entered politics in like 2014, party politics with the UK Independence Party, mostly because, well, I believed that the EU, along with the UN, were attempting to introduce policy, enforce policy, that would bring about the destruction of our unique racial, ethnic and national groups here in the United Kingdom through mass immigration, something that many white nations are suffering themselves. So my main focus was to try and regain our sovereignty so we could get control of our borders by leaving the European Union. So that was my main focus for a while. After Brexit was achieved, and we know that that kind of dragged on for some time, I decided that party politics was probably not best for me. I mean, my opinions on race, on certain political ideologies were well known, and it doesn't really go along with mainstream party politics. And I was sick of the restraints on what I could and could not do. I also noticed that there was a big issue of us trying to get politicians to do things for us, but they would promise the world in elections and then we would get nothing as the Indigenous white peoples. In fact, we just get taxed and have to pay for everything that these foreigners that come into our lands get handed on a plate. So like hotel rooms and pizzas and taxis and their legal fees all paid for and new council houses and free NHS access and school and everything. But I decided that trying to make them do things for us is not the best mode of going about it. If we want something done, we're better off doing it ourselves. And I think that I'd be better as an independent nationalist. Now, I decided that one of the best routes to go down would be utilising our legal systems. So I decided to retrain because previously I'd worked in sales and marketing and analytics, but I would like to transfer into law due to the fact that there is an awful lot of nationalists and white people that are being persecuted by the state purely just for opposing what is their own genocide and ethnic cleansing. So I started studying law, and upon entering university, we all know that universities are incredibly woke places. I was subjected to a highly anti-white environment that was very discriminatory. And when I raised issue with this, my university decided that they were going to discipline me for it. And when I questioned this, they said it was for calling Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization. They also instructed police officers to come to my house and ask me why I thought Black Lives Matter were a terrorist organization. I sent them on their way, telling them that
One of the reasons to think that Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization is precisely because the establishment is so afraid of them that they are persecuting people like you for pointing out this uncomfortable fact.
Well, we have a very funny interpretation here in the United Kingdom of what terrorism is. You see, Black Lives Matter, you know, terrorizing people by tearing down statues, violently assaulting people in the streets, wasn't quite as bad as it was in the United States with them, you know, murdering people and burning down huge chunks of cities. But we did have an awful lot of violence over this Black Lives Matter, George Floyd thing. And that wasn't classed as terrorism. You could incite as much violence as you wanted over that time. But if you're a 13-year-old boy who has the wrong political opinions and owns the anarchist cookbook, you'll be going to prison. I believe that there are people being investigated for listening to hip hop parodies that have been made by a certain artist. And that is now classed as terrorism, listening to music and owning books. But people wanting to blow people up in concerts and, you know, the everlasting flow of foreign hostile fighting age men coming across our border on dinghies, just after the biggest terrorist organization in the world, ISIS, said they were going to flood our nations with their fighters, which many of them have come over with weapons, by the way, and gone missing. That's not classed as terrorism, but white people opposing that is. So we have a very funny interpretation here in the United Kingdom when it comes to terrorism. But going back to what I've been doing. So cut a long story short, I've decided that I was going to sue my university for discrimination against me as a white student, for racial harassment, for discrimination of my philosophical and factual beliefs, particularly around white privilege not being a fact, that systemic racism against Black and ethnic minorities is non-factual, and that can be proven with data, and that Black Lives Matter fits all the criteria that is outlined within the Terror Act of 2000. So I think that I was discriminated against on this basis. I was victimized. So I couldn't resolve these matters with the university internally. So I've decided to take them to court. And apparently this is quite rare for people to decide to take their universities to court. Obviously, I have very much struggled to obtain legal representation. So I'm a litigant in person. I'm representing myself. I'm up against a team of expensive and experienced barristers, but I'm not doing too badly. I just had a hearing on the 30th of June where the defense has actually applied to strike out my claims, and they'd failed to do so. Only two claims pertaining to direct discrimination and indirect discrimination were struck out at that time, which was only two of very many claims. So this trial will be going to court. The mainstream media don't want to write about it, of course, because it's about white people opposing the anti-white agenda, particularly in our education system. Funnily enough, there is a Jewish person that's currently suing her university, and she's had no issues with getting representation, getting the media to talk about it, because she believes that her university has been anti-Semitic. But if you believe that your university has been anti-white, trying to get any sort of publicity around that is impossible. Trying to use crowdfunding, such as crowd justice, I couldn't use that. But luckily, I've managed to teach myself in a very short amount of time what is going to be necessary to advance these claims and represent myself, which I don't think they were expecting, and wanted to create huge barriers for my access to justice, but have failed because they don't like the white working class accessing their legal rights. We're not supposed to be able to do that. Also, my main current work at this time outside of lawfare and trying to get justice for myself and other white students that have been subjected to discrimination and anti-white harassment throughout their studies is the Community Interest Company that I hope will launch at the end of this year. It's moving forward very quickly at this point in time. It's called the White Indigenous Rights Alliance. So a community interest company is very much like a charitable organization, except for I don't need trustees, where the beneficiaries, all the beneficiaries are basically the people that are outlined within our governing documents, which is the white indigenous community alone. Now, people will say that this is discriminatory in itself, but it's not. I mean, if you look up, if you type into Google, for example, charities for white people UK, it will bring up listings for charities like Black Lives Matter. And you'll note there are thousands of community interest companies and charities that are all set up for the interests of random Black and ethnic minorities in our country, but not one to help the white indigenous population, who happen to make up the majority of the homeless, who happen to make up the majority of the deaths of despair and suicide, have the lowest attainment rates in education, have the lowest rates going on into higher education, are the biggest victims of racially and religiously motivated crimes, particularly sexually motivated crimes, like the religiously and racially motivated rape of up to 1 million white British school children by Muslim, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, sometimes African gangs, on an industrial scale. And yet we don't get any justice. We don't get any reports. In fact, you know, just trying to even have people address these issues is impossible. So we don't have any representation. We don't have any say. In fact, we're not even allowed to identify as our own unique racial, ethnic, and national groups. The only time that we can be identified as white British is when we're being blamed for something. So there is a requirement for this. And this community interest company is going to support the rights and lives of the white indigenous communities. It's got four different divisions, 12 different departments. Not all will launch at the same time, but primarily the Our Rights division. This is going to be a policy research and advice think tank. We're going to have an alliance watch, which is going to look for corruption within state institutions and produce reports and possibly bring private prosecutions forward. We'll also bring forth judicial reviews for policies that harm the rights or lives of the white indigenous peoples. We also are going to have an advocacy hub, a help hub to help people who are struggling with anti-white systems and institutions to better communicate and access their rights, communicate with these institutions. There's going to be a community arm that's going to be focused on ending what we say is isolation through cultural connection, because the white indigenous communities have no social cohesion here in the United Kingdom. It's been completely broken down, and any sort of collectivism is frowned upon. So we're going to remedy that with our communities, which will focus on personal improvement programs and better social cohesion within our white indigenous communities. There's an Our Futures department, which is going to have an alternative curriculum. We plan, once we are generating enough funds, to offer a scholarship for disadvantaged white students that are gifted, that are not offered opportunities elsewhere and excluded because they're classed as privileged just for being white. And finally, we have a History, Heritage and Culture department, which is going to have a historical society, a conservation club and a culture hub, whose end goal is really to have a white culture fair to demonstrate the contributions to the advancement of humanity of the white indigenous peoples of Great Britain, our art, our music, our food, you know, all of these things, because we're told that we don't have a culture. And I think it's time that we did start celebrating these things. So that would be the work that I'm doing at this point in time.
Well, that's amazingly ambitious. And I'm very, very impressed. Tell me, how did you become who you are today? How did you become this thought criminal and this activist? What kind of background do you have? What kind of education? How did you start out? This is an interesting story.
Yes, it is an interesting story. So I don't think my background is very typical. I mean, I actually grew up in a reasonably normal family. Mother and stepfather both had decent jobs, but I got moved away from where the rest of my family was to somewhere else. And unfortunately, this new location, when I was in my early teens, I ended up being groomed by one of these religiously and racially motivated gangs of foreign men and was trafficked for a number of years. Due to this, I didn't actually finish my former education because I wasn't going to school. Nobody cared that I was missing. Nobody came looking for me. And even when people sort of knew what was going on, nobody wanted to do anything about it. So I didn't get to finish my education. I did manage to escape this gang as I got bigger and stronger and, how can you put it, braver, because I realized nobody else was coming to save me if I didn't start to fight back myself. And, you know, it wasn't going to end well for me. And I was very lucky that I got out of that situation. But from there, I went off. I did a hairdressing qualification. I tried to study psychology. I struggled a little bit with, how can you put it, going out and partying and not really having any direction in life and knowing what to do. I knew the world was a very messed up place and I could see it, but I felt like nobody else could see how hypocritical and backwards everything was. So I worked in bars and eventually, you know, I did get into politics, but it was sort of behind the scenes. You know how a lot of people do, you read things on the internet, you start exploring. I came across Alex Jones. I found him most interesting. And watching Alex Jones, I saw Nigel Farage. And he was in an interview with Paul Joseph Watson and Alex Jones. And that's when I became aware of the UK Independence Party. I'd recently actually just broken my leg and couldn't walk for like 6 months. So I'd spent a lot of time on the internet watching these things. And I decided to get into party politics because at the local elections, I'd gone down to the poll station to go vote for the UK Independence Party and didn't have anybody to vote for. So I was very angry about this. So I decided to sign up as a member and march down to the nearest branch and introduced myself and declared that I was going to set up a branch in the city that I live in. And I did successfully within a month with four other members, became one of the most successful branches in our region. And I went on to manage a general election campaign. And in the referendum, I ended up managing 62 constituencies in 284 wards, which was kind of an accidental thing that happened because unfortunately the vote leave county coordinator died very early into the campaign and there wasn't really anybody there to replace him. And I'd already started very early because I knew the Tories were going to pull that election, that referendum as soon as they could. So I ended up campaigning in the referendum, ended up a director of the UK Independence Party. At this point, when I was getting more heavily involved in politics and looking at history more, I became more aware of who was behind much of what was going on in my country, and that the EU wasn't as big a problem as the UN, which is basically the global, the public face of the Jewish global world order. So I realized that some of my opinions would have to be kept to myself. I did end up in the news a couple of times, and Hope Not Hate wrote a few articles about my racist and apparently anti-Semitic opinions, but this managed to get quashed somewhat. And I spent some time from 2016 to 2019 being a director of the UK Independence Party. I was eventually booted out at the same time as quite a lot of other people, other members of that party, who were deemed to be too far right, and ended up in the Tory party to help them get Brexit done. But after a dinner where Jacob Rees-Mogg was speaking, I called him a cunt and resigned from the party. Sorry, I'm not sure if I could use that language here. Apologies for my...
Yes, you absolutely can use that language, especially about Tories.
Yeah, well, he did a speech about how Shamima Begum should not have... You know who Shamima Begum is? She was an ISIS bride, said she wasn't bothered about seeing people's heads in bins, and she wasn't sorry about going there and all this stuff. But anyway, now she wants to come back to Britain because she's realised that Syria is a shithole. And he said that her citizenship shouldn't be revoked because this would set a dangerous precedent. My long-term goal, by the way, is to revise and revoke the citizenships that have been granted to foreign nationals since the year 1900. And if they have been deemed to have been granted as an act of genocide under Definition C of the Genocide Convention, then they will be revoked and these people will be removed. And that is my end goal. So this idea that he's coming out with, that we can't revise or revoke citizenships of foreign hostile origined people, I mean, I wasn't tolerating that. So I left the Tory party and that's how I've got to where I am today. But I think I do have a keen sense of justice. I think my past has certainly contributed to that, because realizing when Rotherham broke, those stories about what had happened in these other towns, and I realized the scale of what had taken place, I felt a sense of guilt, duty and responsibility to do something about it. And that's how I am today. It's a sense of deep duty to ensure that other generations of my people do not have to suffer in the same way, suffer the same indignities that we have.
That's inspiring. Who are some of the other people you mentioned? You mentioned Alex Jones, you mentioned Nigel Farage, Paul Joseph Watson. Who are some of the other people who contributed to your thinking, especially around the issue of white genocide or white ethnic displacement, the Great Replacement, however you want to describe it?
I wouldn't say that there's been like particular authors. I mean, there is Joyce online. What's his first name? Andrew Joyce. I found him very informative, but mostly it had been from other people that I'd spoken to in person, because very many people are very scared about talking about certain things online. Like I say, nationalists are very persecuted. So usually it would be with trusted people. It's not talking about certain aspects of politics that other people don't tend to talk about. And that would bring your realization across. And also just from random online postings and then my own research, because I'd see something and think, well, that doesn't correlate with what I've been taught, or, you know, especially since I was a child or whatever. And you get interested and you look it up and you start to realize that you've been lied to an awful lot. So I can't say that anybody's been a significant influence apart from seeing Nigel Farage on the TV that time. I mean, he doesn't like me and I'm not a huge fan of his. I very much respect the work that he's done, but I would like to see him talk about racial aspects a lot more instead of glossing over them, calling people racists when they do talk about it. But apart from those people, I would say I can't really name any particular influences.
Interesting. So do you think that Nigel Farage is aware of race as a factor, or aware of the Jewish power structure, things like that, that keeps it close to his vest? Or is he just clueless? What's your take on him? I see, you know, a picture of you with him in Hope Not Hate. There, you know, so you've been around the guy. You were involved in UKIP. You were a member of the National Executive Committee and so forth. You observed these people up close. What are your thoughts on them?
I've worked in the same organizations. Nigel stepped down as leader at the same time that I became a director. I think he thought that my views were a little bit too far right and a little bit too extreme for his liking. But these people are people that I genuinely do respect. They put an awful lot of time, effort and work. I mean, I've seen the work that these people have put in. And I think they genuinely do believe in their cause. It's just that there are some people who get involved in politics for the right reasons, but politics and particularly some of the things that can come with it can be quite corrupting. particularly if your livelihood relies on it, then it can become quite difficult for people to take any risks with that by saying things that they feel that they shouldn't, because if they are deselected or become unelectable, they might not be able to find work elsewhere. So I think that influences an awful lot of people's decisions on what they will address and what they will not, and how they behave towards people who do address those issues that they'd rather weren't spoken about.
One question that is debated in our circles a lot is how aware mainstream politicians are of, say, the Jewish question or the Jewish power structure, things like that. In your time with UKIP and just sort of in the general sort of immigration concerned right of the British right, I suppose, I'm being kind of inarticulate here, but, you know, Tories and UKIP people who are concerned about immigration, how aware are they of this issue? Are they clueless about this, or are they very clued in and actively working to basically keep these questions suppressed?
In the UK Independence Party, or let's just say in what people call the right, which I don't really see as the right, I see the Conservative Party as Trojan Marxists and are just the same as Labour. They're just two sides of the same communist shekel. However, in the eyes of normie land and normie mainstream politics, there is this view that Israel is our friend and is the only democratic nation in that sort of area of the region that shares our values. And there is this strange thing that if you're on the right, you must support Israel. And if you're on the left, you must support Palestine. And there is no sort of leeway in that. And there is a big lack of awareness. I mean, I'm going to be honest. I mean, for a long period of time, people could class me as a Sivnat. I've had no problem with a small amount of foreign people being in our lands, as long as they add value with the skill sets that they have and don't commit any crimes and things. And also, I wasn't fully aware of the Jew. So I hear people talk about it, but you do have, because of the brainwashing that you've been through, this, how can you put it, core reluctance to even admit it to yourself that, you know, the things that you've been taught about are wrong. But when you start investigating the NGOs, the corporations, the politicians, the people behind Marxist ideology, you can't deny that correlation, that there is, you know, Jewish people that have been directing these things. And you end up saying to yourself, it's not all the Jews. It's not all of them. They're not all of this. But over time, you're like, right, I'm going to have to start investigating this group of people, because in normal mainstream right-wing politics, you don't even talk about or think about the Jew. You don't think about their influence. You're not really aware of it. It's something that's glossed over. I mean, if anything, they always want to point to the Muslim as the problem. Oh, it's the Muslims. The Muslims, they're the one committing the terrorism. They're the one doing the rapes. Yeah, they are doing those things. But who are the ones bringing them here in the first place to do these things that they know that they're going to do against us? And there is a real deep lack of awareness. However, I think that's been shifting in the last few years. I think particularly with the COVID pandemic and the World Economic Forum, I think the realization of Jewish supremacy and the Jewish origins of Marxism is becoming more known within wider circles, even within normie circles. I have people from mainstream party politics who can't openly communicate with me because, you know, it would get them deselected. But they're now asking questions about these things, and particularly things like even about National Socialism and what really happened in the Second World War and what were the reasons for it. And people are becoming a lot more inquisitive. But during my time as a whole, there was a genuine lack of awareness, and also, a core reluctance for the ones that had noticed. There was a bit of a pattern there with these very harmful anti-white agendas and Jewish people being involved in it, not just involved, but heavily directing it and admitted it. There is, as I say, a core reluctance there, but I think that is changing. From what I can see, and it's not just within the echo chambers of people, say, of like Telegram or BitChute and things, it's in mainstream platforms, and people in mainstream politics are now asking questions about these things and addressing it. I think I've even seen Tucker Carlson asking about Jewish supremacy and things. So I do think the cat's getting out the bag, and it might be difficult for our politicians. In fact, they'll probably double down on how they've got to be as non-anti-Semitic as possible, because, well,
our politicians and our political parties are puppets to very rich Jewish people that have control over our financial systems. And everybody knows money rules the world, not democracy, not politicians, not the media. When it comes down to it, money rules the world. And who controls the money? The Jews.
I do have a question here from Eric. Eric sends a number of questions in, and this is actually apropos, although he didn't know you were coming on when he sent this. The question is, what are your thoughts on the grooming gangs that have been uncovered in Great Britain and other European countries? How would you deal with the politicians, social workers, and police officers who did nothing to stop these crimes? And what would you do with the criminals who committed them? I think that's a fair question for somebody who's been there, who's been a victim of this system in the UK. Is it too sensitive a topic, or do you want to talk about this topic in greater detail, and specifically the collaboration of the system in perpetuating this, and also how it can be rooted out? Katie, I think you're muted. Are you with us? Okay, well, until she's back. In the meantime, while we're waiting to solve this technical problem, I can say a few things about this. I mean, obviously, this was a huge scandal. I remember when Rotherham first broke, and the idea that this was just confined to one place was immediately obviously absurd to me. The same causes lead to the same effects. And if you have these communities of largely South Asian Muslim men who are engaged in this kind of basically rape and prostitution, white girls, it's going to be replicated elsewhere. And so I was just waiting for more of this to come out. It was obviously impossible to believe that the authorities in these communities were unaware of this. These things don't happen. These things just don't happen without being reported. And so my initial prediction was, we're going to find that this was pussyfooted around by the establishment. Why? Because they wanted to avoid charges of racism. The first that I heard of all of this, of course, was connected with Mark Collett and the then leader of the British National Party, Nick Griffin, who had been calling attention to this and basically were put on trial for this. This was years before the big explosion of information about Rotherham and then other locations. There was obviously collusion in the establishment throughout the British system to suppress information about these crimes because it might cause xenophobia, and for good reason. This is an example of how, if you want to make rape legal, you don't have to change the law. You just have to basically make rape-prone groups a politically protected class. And then what happens is there's an incentive in place for people to lie, people to make excuses, people to soft pedal what's going on and so forth. And the subsequent investigations of that bore out my initial assumptions about this. There's a piece that I wrote for Countercurrents, I think it was back in 2014, called The Coming Pedophile Rape Epidemic, where I talked about the logic of this. And I used Rotherham as an example, because at the time there was discourse bubbling around on the left and the usual places on the left, trying to make pedophiles the next group of poor, politically correct victims. And I said, if you make pedophiles an object of sympathy, you will unleash an epidemic of rape of children. And for a long time, I sort of sat on that argument until Rotherham came along, because that I thought was proof positive that this would take place. Let me see if there are any more questions that have come in. We'll sort of just do an AMA until maybe she can get back online. Unknown Californian writes in with $10. This is the first time I'm hearing of Katie. Quite a tragic story. I'm happy she's funneling her anger into something so productive. What is the ultimate goal of dispossessing whites? Why is it happening? Keep up the great work, Greg. Why is it happening? Well, because people hate us. That's the simple reason why it happens. Now, of course, people hating us doesn't really matter if they're outside of our borders, if they have no influence on our lives. But what happens if there are people on the inside and people who are extremely powerful who hate us? Well, if they have decisions that they can make that would allow them to do harm to the majority population of whatever society they're living in, they will make those decisions that will harm the majority population. Why? Well, because of enmity, because of hatred toward us. They feel that if we are strong, they're weak and vulnerable. They're in a position of relative power, even though they have small numbers. And so to feel safer, they wish to basically find ways of treading us down, of diluting our population with foreigners, of diluting our morale, of diluting our identity, diluting our ability to fight back, to take our own side. And by weakening the majority population, they feel that they are stronger and safer. That's the general pattern here. So the ultimate goal of dispossessing whites is to make other groups stronger. And, you know, Jews really took the lead in this because they were the group that was inside for a very long time, certainly from the very beginning of the United States. They were inside, yet they didn't feel inside. They had all the privileges of being insiders, but they felt themselves to be hostile outsiders. And they were constantly looking for allies that they could raise up as a way of bringing down the majority population, the white majority. And so wherever they had the power to make decisions that would redound to their benefit and the ill of the white majority, they would do that. Now, here's the thing. You'd think that at a certain point they'd realize, okay, enough is enough, right? We seem to have gotten them under control. They're pretty much at our mercy. We should maybe ease up a little bit on this, lest we create a society that's so chaotic and so filled with conflict and hatred and degeneracy that perhaps it blows up in our face. But they don't really think that way. A lot of it is just sort of a strategy that's been cooked up by a few brains, a few wise elders of their community, and propagated over time. And the way this is propagated is just as sort of, categorical imperatives. You know, always fuck with them if you have an opportunity. You know, things like that. It's categorical. It's not look around, see how things are going, and maybe, you know, inject a little poison into the cultural bloodstream, but maybe not, right? It's nothing like that. It's always done in the form of imperatives. And you have people who are on various spectrums of fanaticism. They're gaining virtue points, brownie points. They can't be opposed because they're a sacred group of people, and opposing them is hate and evil. I've often wanted to have opposition to Greg Johnson be declared the cardinal crime that anyone could commit. If opposition to me were the worst possible sin, I would love that. I really would love that. But, you know, in the long term, it would be really, really bad for me because it would turn me into a monster. I would just become an intolerable monster if nobody could say no to me. If everyone were intimidated about saying no to me or saying, well, wait a second, Greg, maybe there's some little, no, I'm sorry, you can't say no to Greg. You have to go along with his every whim. That would be terrible for my character. And if you're starting with people who aren't paragons of virtue to begin with, and then you give them that kind of immunity from criticism, you're asking for terrible trouble. And what you're getting is a social system where there's no breaks, basically. You have a lot of people working on their own, protected by certain structures of taboos, who are constantly railing against the interests of the established majority. There's no long-range planning here. There's no oversight. There's nothing to reel these people back in and prevent them from completely destroying society and destroying themselves in the process. And that's sort of where we are at this point. And so it's not just hate, it's reckless hate. It's reckless hate, and reckless hate is going to lead to ultimately white extinction if we do nothing about it. And that's why it's so important. Our enemies have no brakes. That means that they will never let up on their own. They have to be stopped. Fortunately, it also means that they have no self-control. Edmund Burke once said that a system that has no ability to change has no ability to preserve itself. Well, another way of putting that is that a car that doesn't have brakes will crash, right? Our enemies don't have brakes, and that means that they're going to crash. They can't control themselves. It's pedal to the metal, anti-white hate all the time. And that means that we will never be able to count on them to moderate themselves. They're never going to be able to moderate themselves. It's all on us, right? And that's both very disturbing and sobering, but it's also kind of liberating because it means that they have a tendency towards excess and self-defeat. It would be nice if we could just defeat our enemies on their own rather than waiting around for them to defeat themselves, right? But they do have this tendency towards excess, and excess leads to their downfall again and again. There's a historical pattern here. So I do think that that's what's going on. What is the ultimate goal of dispossessing whites? Well, in the near run, it's just they feel like they're empowering themselves by making us weaker, but there's no clear ultimate goal here. An ultimate goal is a stopping point, and there's no stopping point here short of basically them being stopped or them destroying everything. So ABC writes in with $5, thank you very much. The interests of the white European race would have been better served if the UK stayed in the EU, using its great power and influence to change things for the better from inside. Do you think the white Europeans have a better chance fighting alone? Well, yes and no. Look, I think it was great that the UK left the EU. Why? Precisely because the UK isn't in the hands of people who are concerned about the good of the white race. Okay. At best, the UK is in the hands of people who are interested in the interests of the British. And of course, there are practically none that actually fit that description, although some will pretend to be that way to get votes, right? To pander to the Brexit leave voters and things like that. There are a lot of people who wanted Britain to be independent and to be able to chart its own course in the world. Its leadership dragged their feet on Brexit for years. Why? Because none of them wanted it. They are all part of the globalist club. So the underlying premise here is that it would be great for the UK to be in the EU so that they can do good for the white race. It's just a non-starter. My view about the European Union is the following, and this is my response to Richard Spencer years ago talking about why the British should stay in the EU. The EU is an anti-white, anti-European organization. Now, in a fantasy world, it could be a different organization, but objectively, it's an anti-white, anti-European organization. Therefore, anything that weakens the EU and weakens its ability to affect white people is good. Period. End of statement. Brexit was good for white people because it weakened the EU somewhat. It didn't turn out to be all that much better for the British because their establishment is still solidly in the globalist club. They're just not taking orders through the EU bureaucracy anymore. They're taking orders through different routes. And realistically, that's what I expected, but it weakened the EU. Great Britain is one of the three pillars of the EU, and it's lost one of its three pillars, the other two being France and Germany. If France were to leave or Germany were to leave, of course, Germany isn't going to leave. The EU is a de facto German empire in Europe. But if France left, the EU would collapse. And so it was a huge blow to the prestige of the EU for the UK, one of the three principal members, to leave. Okay. It was a huge blow to the left because it was a reversal of history, right? They think history is leading to their preferred ends. They think that there's some force out there that is pushing bending, the arc of the universe is bending towards their wishes. That's what they really believe. And suddenly when Brexit happened, they were upset. And then a few months later, they were really upset when Donald Trump happened, because he wasn't part of the plan. He is not what they expected. He is a historical anomaly, and so is Brexit. And the trouble is that it shakes their faith. They are sustained by belief that historical forces are bending their way, and things like Brexit and things like Trump make them crazy, literally crazy. This was good. This was demoralizing to them. They were frenzied and insane, and they're still frenzied and insane about Trump. I'm sure they're probably frenzied and insane about Brexit too. However, I'm just not following it that closely, but it's good that these people suffer any defeat, even if you want to say, well, it wasn't ultimately a defeat for the Great Replacement, etc. Yeah, okay, that's true. But it was still a symbolic, psychological, and potentially political defeat that they suffered. And that's a good thing. I want the EU to suffer every possible defeat. I want them, you know, to trip over. I want them to slip on every banana peel. I want them to suffer every possible humiliation. I don't care how consequential, even if it's merely symbolic, because it's an evil institution. And that means that it's what's bad for it is good for white people. Now, in a fantasy world, of course, there would be a European Union that works for the interests of Europe. That doesn't exist, and it will not exist if the current EU remains. And so anything that destroys the EU also brings us closer to the day when maybe somebody's fantasy EU will exist. But the current EU will not be that institution. That institution that some people hope for can only come about if the existing EU is basically uprooted and destroyed. And all of the bureaucrats and globalists and money men and people who are involved in that are basically given an early retirement, right? And they're just proscribed. They're out of politics entirely. You can't build anything with these people. And so you would have to start something over from scratch if you wanted some kind of European intergovernmental organization that would work to coordinate European countries for the greater interests of the white race in Europe and around the world. The way I likened Richard Spencer's take on this was that he's like a soldier, like a lower ranking officer in a trench in the First World War, and his men are being slaughtered by artillery, raining shells down upon them. And instead of doing what's necessary to save his men, namely destroy that gun, he says, no, we shouldn't destroy that gun, because he can imagine what he would do with that gun. Well, at that point, you go from being a responsible leader to being a dangerous fantasist. You're just not to be taken seriously. If you are under fire and the EU is one of the weapons that's being used against you, the first thing that we do is we take out the enemy gun. We don't imagine what we would do with it in a fantasy world where we control it, a fantasy world we're never going to get to if it keeps raining shells down on us to the point where we are completely dead. So let me check here again. Okay, she's back. She's back for a few minutes. Let's see. Katie, are you there?
Hello, good evening. Really sorry about that. I did pre-warn you that my laptop, there's something wrong with the hardware. I can't connect to the Wi-Fi. Yeah. My phone, I had it on charge and it was 55% when we started the interview, but it just died. It died and then wouldn't recharge. And anyway, I've managed to get an alternative laptop working. So,
oh, okay.
Again, my apologies.
Well, that's fine. That's totally fine. We're glad to have you back. We were all worried about you. We thought the globalists had gotten you or something like that. Now, I was pretty sure it was the technical thing. You warned me about the battery. So, well, we only have about 10 minutes left in this segment now. So let's talk about what's next for you, what you're working on next, what you're currently working on, how people can follow your work, how people can support your work. Because I do think you're obviously extremely articulate, very passionate, and you're going somewhere. So how can we follow you and how can we help?
Well, I have a Bubba Kate versus the State channel on Telegram. There's also a Bubba Kate versus the State round two. That is also an official channel. That's because the original channel has now been censored by Telegram. I'm banned from Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, so you won't find me there. I have a Gab account, but to be honest, I'm not a content creator. A lot of the stuff that I'm doing requires an awful lot of work in the real world. So what I'll be doing is continuing with this court case, along with others that are more personal justice campaigns. And also, we'll be launching this community interest company, the White Indigenous Rights Alliance. And there is an awful lot of work that needs to go into that because it's, how can you put it? You said before, ambitious. There's each division is almost like its own company in itself. And quite a lot of the work that we're going to be doing is very skilled, particularly in the analytics department. And when we're going to be bringing forth litigation against government officials, corrupt government officials, or opposing certain policies through judicial review. So you'll be seeing more of that. But with me, you'll get reports as and when I've got something to report on. But there can be long periods of time where I'm doing lots of boring things like having to create documents and go to court hearings and have lots of meetings with my tech team and people that are going to be putting forth the recruitment procedures. And we've just been working on cybersecurity and integrating certain technologies into our website to make membership and volunteering much easier. When it comes to supporting me, I don't take any financial support at this point in time. I don't feel that it's something that I need to profiteer from in any way. And because I'm a litigant in person with my legal claims, I've not had any legal costs up until now. However, at the last hearing, I was hit with costs of the other side of my application to amend my particulars of claim, which might be out of my financial capabilities with other things that are going on. And obviously, when the White Indigenous Rights Alliance launches, I'll be more than happy to take donations for that organisation. But for my own personal activism, I don't think it's something that I need to do or would be willing to do at this stage, unless it was, you know, at a point where I could not afford the court fees to move forward to pursue justice, which really shouldn't be a thing. Equal access to justice is supposed to be a right within our country, regardless of your socioeconomic circumstances. But they make litigation as difficult and expensive as possible to deter people from moving forward of their own accord so that they always have control over that environment with peoples who have been sworn in through the temple, which happened to also apparently now swear some sort of oath to be champions of diversity. So yeah, not necessarily to be trusted. But yes, that's what I'm going to be doing. There isn't really a way to support me apart from sharing my work. And if you want to become involved or you think you've got skills that might be advantageous to the White Indigenous Rights Alliance, at the moment I'm looking for analysts, I am looking for content creators, I'm looking for people who would be able to contribute to personal improvement programs, to historical celebration. We want to have an on this day where we celebrate the contributions to the advancements of humanity that the white people have done. So if you go on my page at Paris, and I'll then DM you and we can get into a discussion about how you might be able to help, because I believe the best thing people can be doing right now is improving themselves and contributing to, well, saving our people in whatever way they can. And this is the best means that I think we can go about it, is by collectivizing and supporting our own interests as our own people. So yeah, that's the best way people can support me, is your skills and your knowledge. I need these things more than your money at this point. There'll come a time when I'm going to need some money off you as well to keep this company running and to manage to achieve all of our objectives. Some of them will require a fair bit of cash because we wish to acquire land and properties. We wish to offer a scholarship. We want to eventually launch an online school for people who want to do homeschooling with our alternative curriculum, which of course will teach a true dissemination of history and promote a healthy racial pride within our peoples, particularly young people like children. But yeah, that's the best way people can support me. That's the best way people can find me. I don't know whether you might be able to post links to my different social media. I have a YouTube channel as well, Bubba Kate versus the State. It might be a bit shadow banned, but if you can post links to your page to mine, that would be fantastic if people want to find me. And like I say, at Paris, if you think you've got skills or knowledge that you might want to contribute, and we can have a discussion about that. And that's how you can support me and my objectives at this time.
So do you have a web page, or are you just on Telegram and Gab?
I thought about making a Bubba Kate versus the State website, and I'd actually created it one on GoDaddy, and then I decided not to move forward with it because most of the activities that I'll be doing after this year will be within the White Indigenous Rights Alliance organization, because we're more powerful as a group than we are as individuals. I've experienced this. So as much as I've got my own personal justice campaigns, I don't think that's necessarily something that should go onto a website. It's a bit narcissistic, especially if it doesn't add anything overall to our own peoples. If it's just something that personally benefits me, then it's not really of interest to anybody else. So I thought it would be more narcissistic to have a website than valuable and a bit time consuming.
Let me channel millennial woes here, who would probably say, well, it would be useful given that you are an individual with a name and a profile and who are involved in many different activities to have one place where people can go and follow everything that you're doing. So I can see the logic of that. One question I have, and this is just a trivial question compared to all the other things, but I got to ask it. In America, the word Bubba means brother. So how did you get to be Brother Kate rather than Sister Kate? I'm just curious where that nickname came from.
My dad has got a bit of an eccentric personality, and he decided to give all of his daughters nicknames. My older sister got the name Sparrow Legs. My younger sister got the name Benito Mussolini. And I'm quite annoyed about this because she gets her own theme tune, right? When she walks in a room, na 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 na, Benito, 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 na 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 na. And I rather liked Benito Mussolini. So anyway, I ended up being called Bubba Kate Paris. And apparently this is because when I was born and when I was a newborn, I was quite chunky. And apparently I looked like an American football player. And there was one, which I don't know where this came from. Apparently one of his friends said something about, oh, she's built like Bubba Paris. And apparently there's a big black guy that used to be an American footballer called Bubba Paris. And then my dad just stuck that name to me. And because when I first got involved in politics, I was working in sales and recruitment. It's a very networking based role, and you can upset clients very easily, and contracts can go off to other people and your boss is going to be upset. So I used the name Bubba Kate Paris to conceal my own identity at that time, because I was worried about how it would impact my career and livelihood if my identity were to be known. But now I'm as docs gets, but I still use the name Bubba Kate Paris because a lot of people who were following me previously would look for me under that name. It's reasonably unique, so I don't think there's anybody else with it, so I'm quite easy to find from that name. Whereas if I went back to my own name, Katie Fanning, that would make me actually more difficult to find from my following previously. And like I've said, these people are now asking questions about things that I was talking about a few years ago, like population replacement, white genocide, Jewish supremacy. So I want these people to be able to find me. That's why I continue to use the name, despite the fact that my real name is already well known.
Oh, that's really interesting. Isn't it strangely ironic that your nickname that people are converging on for pro-white messaging is based on a black American football player? I think that's one of the kind of delicious little ironies that history's full of. And yeah, I think you should just go with it. That's funny. That's genuinely funny and memorable. So Katie, thank you so much for coming on. It's been great. And since we got cut off, I want to have you come back again soon so we can have a full conversation and just dig into more of your intellectual journey and your ideas, and you know, let our listeners ask you questions and things like that. So if you're willing to come back, I'd love to have you back for another show on Countercurrents Radio.
Of course, I'd be more than willing to come back. It's been enjoyable this evening for the parts that I've been able to contribute to. I am very sorry about the tech issue. I did pre-warn you in advance. That's why I didn't go ahead. I mean, you said it's a radio show anyway, but I was a bit worried before we went live because sometimes with StreamYard, people to have the video, and I know that my phone wouldn't have been able to last that long with video, but I thought we'd be fine with audio and it cut off. But I know there was a lot of people with a lot of questions that they wanted to ask. So yeah, I'm more than happy to return and answer those questions that people wanted to ask, and yourself as well, to continue the interview. And I'll be less busy over the next few weeks. So if you want to schedule that in at any point, that'd be
great. We will pencil you in very, very soon and have you back. Thank you so much, though. It's been great to get acquainted, and we will continue the conversation on another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
Thank you very much for having me on. You have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye.